They were a diverse group of individuals. Crocker was an experienced and effective organizer of projects and men. Hopkins was an astute businessman. Stanford was a lawyer who also had significant political influence. But it was Huntington who would eventually really run the Central Pacific while the Transcontinental Railroad was being built. It was he who would assume the critical role of seeing to it that supplies reached the Central Pacific work crews whenever and wherever they were needed. And it was he who would also continually lobby Congress for more financial support for the Central Pacific. Although Judah had his initial funding, he still needed the government's support. Again, he headed for Washington, hoping to at last convince the government to give him the bulk of the money his new company still needed. This time, he got a very different reception because the nation's political situation had changed dramatically. The South had indeed seceded from the Union. The Civil War had begun. No longer were there Southern congressmen in Washington committed to blocking any cross-country railroad that took a northern route. Most important, the new American president, Abraham Lincoln, was a strong champion of a transcontinental railroad. Though many in Congress were opposed to undertaking such a costly and difficult project in the midst of a civil war, Lincoln believed that just as the war was being fought to unite the North and the South, an iron road across the country would bind East and West. It would make Americans across the nation feel like one people. A railroad to the Pacific Ocean, he stated, is imperatively demanded in the interests of the whole country. The federal government ought to render immediate and efficient aid in its construction. On July 1, 1862, Lincoln put that immediate and efficient aid into law when he signed the Pacific Railway Act. It authorized the Central Pacific Railroad to lay tracks from Sacramento to 150 miles beyond the California-Nevada border, and it created a whole new company to be called the Union Pacific Railroad Company. It would lay its rails westward until the two companies joined tracks. The government would pay each company $16,000 for each mile of track it laid in flat territory and $32,000 for each mile of track laid in the mountains. In addition, for each 40-mile section of track it completed, each company would be given thousands of acres of government-owned land that it could sell to people who wanted to settle on it. With one stroke of his pen, Abraham Lincoln had made the construction of a transcontinental railroad a reality. President Lincoln had done something else as well. By authorizing the Central Pacific to begin laying its tracks eastward and creating the Union Pacific to set down rails westward, he had set the stage for an extraordinary race to see which company would lay the most miles of track before the two sides of the country were linked. It would become the most dramatic and most heralded race the nation had ever known. The Big Four. As the Pacific Railway Act became law, the United States Congress issued a proclamation publicly thanking Theodore Judah for having made the act possible. But gratified as he was, Judah knew that the real work was just beginning. Informing his new partners that the railroad bill had been passed, he said, "We have drawn the elephant. Now let us see if we can harness him up." With Stanford as president, Huntington as vice president, Hopkins as treasurer, and Crocker as construction supervisor, the Central Pacific's Big Four appeared to be the perfect team to make the vision of a transcontinental railroad a reality. As Huntington would later write, "Each of us complemented each other in something the other lacked. There was Stanford, for instance, a man who loved to deal with people. He was a good lawyer. There was Mark Hopkins. He was a thrifty man. Then there was Crocker, the organizer, the executive, the director of men." Huntington himself, who would become the real boss of the company, possessed a world of business knowledge. As much as the Big Four believed that the nation should have a cross-country railroad, they also wanted to make as much money out of the project as they possibly could. And they were willing to use any means, no matter how devious, to enrich themselves. To his dismay, Judah realized that it had been easier to chart his way through the mountains than it would be to overcome the unbridled greed of the men with whom he had allied himself. From the beginning, the Big Four held meetings without Judah's knowledge. They didn't want him to know about the dishonest things they were planning to do. Soon after Leland Stanford became president of the Central Pacific, he was elected governor of California. Almost immediately, he used the power of his office to illegally transfer more than $1 million of state funds into the Central Pacific's treasury. And Collis Huntington, knowing that the Central Pacific would be paid according to the number of miles of track it laid, began to make plans to bribe geologists to grossly overstate how many miles of rail the company set down. By the fall of 1863, Judah had had enough. Appalled by his colleague's behavior, he left for San Francisco and sailed to New York, where he hoped to find new investors who would buy the Big Four out. If the railroad that Judah had set in motion had been in place, his trip would have been a relatively quick and easy one. But in the fall of 1863, his best option was to sail to Panama, take a train to the Atlantic coast of that isthmus, and then travel by ship to New York. Tragically, while crossing Panama, Judah contracted the dreaded yellow fever. He became so ill that when he arrived in New York, he was taken on a stretcher directly to his hotel. It was while he was lying there that the first rails of the Central Pacific Line were laid. But Judah never heard about it. The man who had made it all possible died before the news could reach him. Charlie Crocker, the construction supervisor, would be on the scene for the entire building of the Great Iron Road. He took to his new job with a passion. He had never worked in construction, but he had spent several years in the California mining fields, where he had earned a reputation for toughness and for taking on any task, no matter how difficult. "I had all the experience necessary," Crocker would later state. "I knew how to manage men. I had worked them in the ore beds, in the coal pits, and worked them all sorts of ways, and had worked myself right along with them." At his side was construction boss James Strobridge, who was equally demanding of the labor force. James Strobridge, the man Charles Crocker chose to be the Central Pacific's construction boss, was a burly Irishman from Vermont. At the age of 16, he began working as a track layer on the Vermont Central Railway and then helped build other railroad lines in New England. When gold was discovered in California in 1849, Strobridge, like thousands of others, raced to the gold fields. Failing to strike it rich, he tried his hand at farming, freighting, and canal building before becoming a construction foreman on the San Francisco and San Jose Railroad. Strobridge, called Stro by his friends, was a rough-and-ready man who often carried a pick-handle with him to settle disputes. Fond of saying that men generally earn their money when they work for me, he was a most demanding boss. But he would prove to be the perfect man to guide and prod a unique army of laborers through some of the most difficult tasks any construction workers had ever been asked to perform. Strobridge would have the distinction of being the only man from either the Central Pacific or the Union Pacific to have a home life throughout the entire building of the road. His wife, Hannah Maria Strobridge, and their 6 children traveled with him in a boxcar pulled by a locomotive. The Strobridges had converted the car into a 3-bedroom house on wheels. Mrs. Strobridge had then refined it by adding a front porch complete with an awning, hanging plants, and a caged canary swinging from the rafters. The San Francisco newspaper, the Alta California, described the living quarters as a house that would not discredit San Francisco. The homey presence of Strobridge's family did not have the effect of moderating his foul language or fierce temper, nor did it stop him from working 12 to 14 hours a day as the boss of what would become the largest single workforce in America. And Hannah Strobridge earned her own distinction. Referred to by the workers as the heroine of the CP, she became the only woman to travel the route of either line during its construction. James Strobridge and Charles Crocker had an enormous problem. The Central Pacific's board of directors had failed to supply them with a large enough labor force. Crocker had managed to hire a number of unemployed Irishmen, but there were only 500 of them. And every week, more and more of them suddenly left to seek their fortunes in the Nevada silver mines. A desperate Crocker tried to solve the problem by placing an advertisement in the California newspapers. "Wanted," it read, 5,000 laborers for constant and permanent work, also experienced foremen. Apply to J.H. Strobridge, superintendent. On the work, near Auburn. He got only a few hundred responses. Most able-bodied men were off in the mountains, hoping to strike it rich in the silver mines. More desperate than ever, Crocker came up with an idea. There were more than 55,000 Chinese people living in California. Tens of thousands had been lured there by the gold strikes in the late 1840s and early 1850s. When the gold ran out, many had taken jobs as laborers, gardeners, domestic workers, and fishermen. Because the Chinese population referred to their homeland as the Celestial Kingdom, Californians called them Celestials. And because of differences in the way they looked, spoke, and conducted themselves, most of them had been victims of racial prejudice and discrimination. But not even their detractors could deny that Chinese men had a great capacity for work. Crocker wanted to hire them for the Central Pacific, but he ran into stiff opposition from Strobridge, who believed that most Chinese men were too small and too fragile to tackle such heavy and exhausting work. Besides, stated Strobridge, they knew nothing about building a railroad. "I will not boss Chinese," Strobridge declared. Crocker had a ready answer. "They built the Great Wall of China, didn't they?" he responded. "And people who could do that ought to be able to build a railroad." Finally, the two men reached a compromise. They would hire 50 Chinese laborers on a trial basis and see how they worked out. When the first Chinese men arrived, Strobridge, convinced that they were too frail to swing heavy sledgehammers or pickaxes, put them to work doing simple tasks such as filling dump carts. Surprised at how quickly they carried out their tasks without a hint of complaint, Strobridge decided to test them further by having them attempt to prepare a roadbed on which tracks could be laid. The result was even more surprising to him. The roadbed the Chinese workers laid down was longer and much smoother than the ones the Irish workers had been able to construct. Then Strobridge decided to put the Chinese to the ultimate test by having them blast rock. Not only did they handle this dangerous assignment without a hitch, they actually seemed to enjoy it. Reporting on what he had seen these initial Chinese laborers accomplish, one of Crocker's engineers stated simply, "The experiment has proved eminently successful." Convinced that they had found the solution to their serious labor problem, Strobridge and Crocker sent agents throughout the Pacific Coast seeking to find as many Chinese workers as they could. They also contacted agents who specialized in finding laborers overseas and commissioned them to obtain Chinese workers for the Central Pacific. It would be a time-consuming process, and it would not be until January 1865 that Chinese laborers would join the CP's ranks in great numbers. But eventually, more than 10,000 Chinese men would make up almost 90% of the Central Pacific's workforce. Hiring the Chinese workers turned out to be the most important decision the Central Pacific made in meeting the challenges of building the Transcontinental Railroad. The Chinese men were not only magnificent workers, they were also more dependable and more willing to take on any task, no matter how difficult or dangerous, than almost any of the others who labored on the Great Road. And there was something else, something that was also extremely important. Throughout the almost 7 years of the Transcontinental's construction, the Chinese men would remain far healthier than most of the other workers. It was probably because of their diet and habits. The food that the Irish workers ate was supplied to them by the Central Pacific. It consisted mostly of beef, beans, and potatoes. There were no fresh vegetables. It was hardly a healthy diet. The Irishmen quenched the constant thirst that arose from their heavy labors by drinking from the streams and lakes they encountered. The water was often brackish and full of harmful bacteria. Many of the Irish workers would lose time on the job as a result of the dysentery they got from drinking the tainted water. The Chinese diet was altogether different. Even though, because of the prejudicial feelings of the times, the Chinese were paid less than the Irish, each of their work crews hired its own cook. One of his duties was to purchase a wide variety of healthy foods from the Chinese districts in San Francisco and Sacramento. The workers' diet included fish, bean sprouts, mushrooms, rice, and cabbage. The cooks even kept pigs and chickens so that on weekends fresh pork, bacon, and poultry could be served. Equally important, the Chinese laborers never drank water directly from the streams and lakes. Instead, they drank hot tea. It was a good drink of choice because boiling the water for it removed bacteria and other harmful elements. The tea was carried to the work sites in huge barrels, suspended from each end of a bamboo pole balanced on the shoulders of special members of the crews called tea boys. Thanks to the Chinese workforce, the labor problem that had so plagued the Central Pacific had been solved, and in a way that neither Strobridge nor Crocker, nor the other directors of the CP, could have ever hoped for. Among those who recognized what the Chinese workers meant to the CP was the company's president, Leland Stanford. For years, he had bitterly opposed Chinese immigration. Now he publicly proclaimed that it would be of great benefit if at least 500,000 Chinese were allowed to immediately enter the country. On January 8, 1863, still long before Chinese workers began joining the CP's ranks, the Central Pacific officially began laying tracks. Thousands of Californians traveled to Sacramento to look on as Leland Stanford ceremoniously shoveled the first load of dirt, signifying the beginning of the laying of a roadbed, called grading, for the first section of tracks. On October 26, 1863, another milestone took place when Strobridge's men spiked the CP's first rails to their ties. But this time, there was no ceremony. Even this early on, it had become all too clear that being able to lay tracks over and through the mountains was far from a certainty. The decision to omit a ceremony was made by Collis Huntington. "If you want to jubilate in driving the first spike, go ahead and do it. I don't," he had telegraphed Crocker. "These mountains look too ugly, and I see too much work ahead. We may fail, and I want to have as few people know it as we can. And if we get up a jubilation, any little nobody can drive the first spike. But there are many months of hard labor and unrest between the first and the last spike."